Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from June 10, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Upajjhatana Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the five subjects to contemplate to develop the Eightfold Path. There's a related article on my website, and also an archive of all my Dhamma articles and talks. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. Okay, today's talk is on the Upajjhatana Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches that there are five subjects that should be mindfully considered as part of developing release from clinging. And these, you'll see that these five subjects relate directly to relate directly to clinging and also relate directly to dukkha, to the First Noble Truth. The Buddha's teachings are presented in the context of developing understanding of the First Noble Truth, that there is dukkha, and release from the Second Noble Truth, clinging originates dukkha. And I realize that I should probably stop simplifying that First Noble Truth so often just by saying that there is dukkha or dukkha occurs, because whenever the Buddha described the First Noble Truth, he stated it in the long form. Birth is suffering, birth is dukkha, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, not getting what is desired is suffering, dukkha, getting what is undesired is suffering, and he always concluded that with saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. And again, the simple explanation of the five clinging aggregates is that's just the personal experience of suffering. It's how we identify. In fact, the Buddha would often say that we join to suffering because we create identities over the things that we want and the things that we don't want. And even by joining to the things that we want, we're creating suffering because everything is impermanent. And even a little bit more subtle than that, we're clinging ourselves, we're creating a condition for our life. In other words, for me to be happy, I need to have chocolate cake every night. Back to chocolate cake. That's suffering. We are the ones that are creating that dukkha in our lives. Is that clear? And then the second noble truth says that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering, and that's what is just described there. So, the Upajjhatana Sutta teaches to be mindful of subjects most people would rather avoid thinking about and have great aversion to. The purpose of reflecting on these subjects is to develop an understanding of these unavoidable aspects of dukkha and the unavoidable aspects of simply having a human life, and to see the impermanence and unsubstantiality of these subjects. They are all simply a part of human experience. Aversion arises to them due to a clinging mind influenced by an impermanent ego personality. Again, this is what I want, this is what I don't want. And most of those things that we say that we need to be happy or need to avoid to maintain our happiness or our security, we have no control over. Some of them we do, but most of them we don't. So the Buddha teaches there are these five facts that one should be mindful of and reflect on often. The first one is, I am subject to aging and I have not gone beyond aging. And that last part of it, I have not gone beyond, meaning you're still clinging to the idea that aging is unpleasant, but it's even more than that, that you actually have some control over it. So that simple statement, how the Buddha begins describing dukkha, birth is suffering, sickness, aging, death, it's simply to remind us that there's things in life that we have absolutely no control over, including aging. And most people don't get too hung up on it, but most people don't want to think about it either, which means you still have a little bit of a hang up on it. You don't want to. I remember a few years ago, my father's about 240 now, but he's actually 99. When he just turned 80, I thought maybe this is a good time to see what he's thinking about. And I said, you know, me and my father never had real deep conversations simply because he doesn't like to get in touch with too many things. So I said, Dad, what do you think about dying? Are you concerned about it? That doesn't bother me. But not in a way that was. You could see he was agitated even by me asking the question, so I have yet, you know, I'll never ask it again. But it was a typical response. Everybody knows that we're going to die, but we don't want to contemplate it. And the reason why the Buddha points it out is that, yes, we're going to die. We only have so much time. Take to the Dhamma like your hair is on fire, like he would often say. Get it done before you die. so you can stop doing it again. The Dalai Lama would say the purpose of time is to awaken. That's why we're here. We don't have all the time in the world. We only get X number of minutes. The next one is, I am subject to illness and have not gone beyond illness. Meaning we're still clinging to the idea that somehow illness will never befall us. Of course it will. If we're human beings, it will. And when it happens, we should at least try to maintain a measure of peace, be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. I think all of you have had the same experience that I have. Even when we get a little bit of a cold, I'm sorry, maybe you don't have one.
Yeah.
Just be out.
Allergies.
But when you have it, it feels like you're going to, that's how you're going to feel forever.
Yes.
Even though you know, 24 hours, maybe a week, this is, but when you feel like that, you feel like you're going to feel like that forever. That's what the Buddha's pointing out. It's impermanent. Don't overreact to impermanent states. Be at peace with them. When you got a cold, you got a cold. When you feel like you're starting to age a little bit, it's okay, but it's also a reminder you got work to do, meaning take to this. You don't have forever. And I can say that there's things that I never considered. I really started feeling, it's not that I'm old, I'm 61, but I started feeling and being mindful of physical changes maybe about a year or two ago, and if I really think about it, probably 20 years ago, but in an obvious way. And what it's done for me is to really appreciate what's going on right now, not in a clinging way, but just, I really don't have forever. This is wonderful just to have this life that I have and the things in my life, you know, the being with my dog or having a nice meal or whatever it might be. But again, not in a clinging way, just recognize that I'm not always going to have this opportunity. I might as well appreciate it now. And that always leads me back to, I don't have the opportunity. I won't have the opportunity to awaken. And even beyond that, I had a great question from a student a couple months ago now. He says, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? Why wouldn't he? You know, I still have that opportunity in a physical form to sit and meditate and take refuge in that gentle beauty of just being present without needing anything to be different. It's just wonderful. Oh, okay, so excuse my going off on a little bit. The third one, and it relates to the other two, is I am subject to death, and I have not gone beyond death. An interesting line when it applies to death. I haven't gone beyond that. When the Buddha awakened, he said a series of things, and then he said, sitting there like that, touching the earth with his right hand, for me there will be no future rebirths. I'm done. He's not coming back again. That points to the ultimate goal is to stop creating the conditions where we are continually coming back into a realm of existence that's prone to suffering and confusion and death. Prone to dukkha. Get the job done. We don't have to put ourselves through this anymore. Does that leave any of you thinking a little bit too much, maybe? I don't often talk about the ultimate goal of the Dhamma. In our moment-by-moment life, the point is that in this moment, to stop creating the conditions that would give birth to another moment that's prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. Right? So we can live a calm and peaceful life in the midst of a phenomenal world that is itself prone to suffering. If we have a physical life, we're going to be prone to sickness, aging, and death. We're going to be prone to not getting what we want. We're going to be prone to getting what we don't want. That's just part of the deal. So ultimately, we want to stop recreating the conditions that cause that to happen, even in, I don't want to get into a talk about rebirth or reincarnation, but even in future lives. We want to get the job done now. But I'm wondering if that leaves you confused or even concerned.
I don't feel concerned, but I do see how those statements can sort of create a kind of urgency that could create that urgency within me during certain times or in certain mind states where it's like I have to hurry up and enjoy this moment, which is, I know, not what you're saying. But,
well, I can see, though.
It is, you know, the whole hurry up and wake up. But I really, the first thing that you said when you restate it, for some reason, like within the context of learning about what we should be thinking about, you explaining again or saying again the long version of the first noble truth, the first time I'm hearing you say it as if you're thinking about these things, then you're clinging. Or if you're worried about these things, then you're clinging.
As opposed to just, this is a, just a statement of fact. This
right.
is the way, yes, and that's the awakened mind state.
Right.
And again, the reason why I describe awakening as being fully mature, a fully mature person doesn't react to things that are here. They're just the truth. So we can be present and at peace with the ongoing process of having a human life, knowing that it is prone to suffering, simply as part of having this life. And that also leads to not becoming over-enamored. It's really an ego personality that says that everything is wonderful and not wanting to let go of just having the experience. And that's not to say that there aren't wonderful things. But when we create identities over that, that's where the problem is. And whenever I talk about this, I always think of beautiful sunsets, and in particular, a few in my life that are just—they were so remarkable that when they happened, I wanted to have them. I wanted—like I've talked about this—the green flash in Hawaii. I wanted them to happen again the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And when they didn't, when I didn't have this most magnificent sunset, did I say sunrise before? I might have. I was disappointed by just a normal beautiful sunset. It wasn't good enough, and that was a great lesson for me. An ego personality is never satisfied, no matter what it was. It could have had, the next day could have had an even better sunset, and it still wouldn't have been enough because I want, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we become enamored with life, and then we think that we should be enamored with life.
Right.
That's, it's almost sacrilegious to not be clinging to life, to not say that this is just the most wonderful, positive experience all the time. That was even common during the, that was a common view during the Buddha's time, even though he was recognizing the suffering all around him. It's okay to see things clearly. It's not negative thinking to recognize that there's suffering in the world, and it, and it's part of the human condition that it's prone to suffering. And that frees you from wanting life to be any different than it is. We can enjoy the moments in life or the periods in life that are just simply enjoyable without a lot of stress. But we also, and we don't overreact to that. We don't cling to these things like we just won the lottery. When we can do that, we also don't overreact to when life throws us a curveball. It's simply part of life. We are able to maintain our peace, our equanimity, and be present with our life, which is really the most important thing. Life takes on much more meaning and much more depth when we can be fully present with it without the need for what's occurring right now to be any different than it is. Most important, we usually reflect that outside, but it's really an inside job. When we can be at peace with the way we are with our life as our life unfolds, we won the game. And that's continually. Okay, so getting to the fourth one. And probably the most important. Remember when I talked about the Buddha's first teaching, taught the Four Noble Truths, and Kandana heard it and said, he awakened, he says, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. What he understood, and the Buddha said, you got it, you understand. What he was referring to on a very, very deep and profound level was an understanding of the impermanence of all things, including his own views of himself. So the fourth thing to contemplate, I am subject to impermanence and the suffering of being separated from all that I hold dear and appealing, and I have not gone beyond separation, disappointment. The Pali word for that is a little bit, separation, disappointment is a little long and involved, but that's what it means. I have not gone beyond the conditioned thinking that creates disappointment of being separated from what I think I need to have to be happy. I've not gone beyond separation, disappointment. An awakened human being has gone beyond that. There's no more separation, disappointment, because there's nothing left to separate from. Meaning that you have not attached yourself to anything, including views of yourself, which are all impermanent. And just think about, it may not be obvious from one day to the next, but think about views that you held of yourself maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago or when you were much younger. about what you thought was important and how they're completely different today. The fifth one, I am owner of my actions. I receive, this is speaking directly to karma. I am the owner of my actions. I receive the results of my actions. Dukkha arises through my actions and I am associated to my actions. Whatever I do, I will inherit. These are the five facts one should be mindful of and reflect on. Then the Buddha describes how to reflect on these subjects. This is important in order to keep these five subjects in context and not form even more confused views. How to think and what to be mindful of is an aspect of right mindfulness. And of course it is. The Buddha is really teaching us to go from a wrong view, a wrong way of looking at the world and our relationship to the world, to a right view that is based on the true nature of reality, based on an understanding of Four Noble Truths. I know you've heard me say it often, dependent origination in its short form says from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. That's why he taught Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha teaches to reflect on being subject to aging and not yet having gone beyond aging. Be mindful that there are those things that are intoxicated with youth, and due to this intoxication are unskillful in thought, word, and deed. I don't think there was plastic surgery back then. But he's kind of referring to that too, going to great lengths. And again, I got to say, the Buddha's not saying we shouldn't take care of ourselves. We shouldn't maintain the body in as healthy a physical way as we can. But again, a middle way, don't become obsessed with it. You know, I hear these stories now about young people, I was going to say young girls, but it's boys too, that are getting plastic surgery at 14 and 15 years old. And it's just, not to fix something that needs to be fixed, just to make themselves look a little prettier. And so the Buddha is saying, reflect on that, and not in a morbid way, in a mindful way, to reflect on this is just a constant, this is a way. A way of aging. There is an image. I don't know why I think about this. The Prime Minister of Indira Gandhi, and I just remember seeing her pictures of her. She's probably been dead 20, 30 years now, but she had this very wrinkled face. But I still remember when I first saw it. What a beautiful woman! And it was because her whole life was there in her face. It didn't her aging didn't detract from her beauty in any way. And I still have that thought. And I tend to look at that in general anyway. I think if we accept the way we looked, we can reflect to who we are. You know, I think that's important. Getting off the subject. Reflect on being subject to illness and not yet having gone beyond illness. Simply a part of life. So when something befalls me that I wish wouldn't, you accept it. And it's just part of the deal. You know, it's not... I don't need to take it personally. It's not because of some ill fortune or some universal force that's acting against me because of something terrible that I did 5 years ago. It's just part of aging. It's part of having a human life. Not having gone beyond on illness, be mindful that being intoxicated with health, one acts unskillfully in thought, word, and deed. Again, the Buddha's talking about this 2,600 years ago. But I think we all know... people, maybe ourselves, that went too far, spent too much time in the gym, or are too over-concerned about every little morsel they put in their body. There was a short period of time in my life when I was traveling to Hawaii a lot. This is 30 years ago. But every trip I would spend an inordinate amount of time in sun booths. I'm even slightly embarrassed to say it. Because I wanted to go to Hawaii looking good. You know, like I was a native or something. I don't know what that stuff is, but that's what the Buddha's talking about. I wasted a lot of time and money in this silly booth. Intoxicated with health, one acts unskillfully in thought, word, and deed. Reflecting on being subject to death and not yet having gone beyond death, be mindful that being intoxicated with life, one acts in unskillful ways in thoughts, words, and deeds, and all kinds of things. You know, we think we're going to live forever, so we start hoarding our possessions, especially when we start creating identities about that. And we start creating... schemes of how we can hold on to stuff even after we're dead. I mean, that's not to say you shouldn't do estate planning, because I got a question about that. You mean I shouldn't worry about that? Yes, you should take care of your kids, but don't become obsessed about what the pharaohs did they insisted on being buried with all the junk they accumulated. Again, just an example. Be mindful of being intoxicated with life. One acts in unskillful ways in thoughts, words, and deeds. Reflecting on being subject to impermanence and being separated from what is held dear and appealing, and not yet. Actually, I interjected that yet. That wasn't part of the sutra, but just to remind us that we can get past this. And not yet having gone beyond separation, disappointment. Be mindful that clinging through desire and passion, one acts in unskillful ways in thought, words, and deeds. And he's just talking about the ongoing moment-by-moment clinging that we all do in life. And we're clinging ourselves to things that are completely impermanent. And especially clinging to views and assumptions of ourselves that have arisen out of ignorance. And that's really the common problem. We create a view of ourselves, of who we are in relation to the world, and most of us spend our entire life defending that view and feeding that view, rather than recognizing the views are impermanence. Let go of the views, like the Buddha would say to Vajragoda, let go of the views, and you live your life in lasting peace and happiness. And then, again, a question comes up a few times, and it's up on the charts. So how do I live in the world? Meaning, don't you need to have a self-referential view? You don't. But what is that like? It means that now your ongoing life and your experience is simply a reference to what's occurring without it happening to me. You're not taking life in a personal way. That's a very difficult thing for most of us to understand. How can I live in the world without me in it? But you can. That's the whole point of the teachings. And all that means is that in the moment, but each moment that occurs, you're at peace with your life as it unfolds. And that can lead to this thought, well, don't I need to do something about what's going on? You will. You'll do what's necessary, and you'll do it in a much more mindful way without any underlying unnecessary fear. So I keep thinking about, I think it was the first retreat we did, I was giving a talk similar to this. And I noticed that somebody was getting agitated, and I called on him because I knew he was ready to ask a question. He says, what happens when you're standing on a train track and a train is coming? You take two steps to the right. Just because you're not taking things personally doesn't mean you should get slammed by an oncoming train. And it doesn't mean you won't have the sense to do it. In fact, you might move a little bit quicker because you won't be thinking, oh, what's going to happen to me? And you'll take two calm steps to the right or to the left, and a train won't hit you. That's the same as living our life as dukkha occurs without sticking the second arrow through reaction. Reflecting on being subject to being the owners of one's actions or karma, and not yet having gone beyond being the owner of one's actions, meaning extinguishing our karma, be mindful that it is in thought, word, and deed that I can go beyond being subject to my actions. So when I describe karma, I describe it this way. The karma is a present moment unfolding, excuse me, of past intentional acts moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. What that means is we are always stuck in karma, which is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, until we start developing and interrupting that conditioned thinking. And then each minute, you've heard me say this before, then it points to the potential of each moment. Then each moment has a potential to incline our minds towards awakening rather than being stuck in that ignorant view and continuing karma. And again, this is another key point of the Dhamma that all reflects back to anatta, the five clinging aggregates, and all the way back to dependent origination. If I continue on the retreat, we talked about becoming often, and there's a large chapter in the next book. If we have developed deep concentration enough to hold the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path as a framework for our life, then each moment is a moment of inclining ourselves towards awakening, towards developing freedom, towards developing non-reaction to normal dukkha. We simply accept it. We understand this is part of life, but on a profound way. Further, consider that as a follower of the Eightfold Path, one is not the only one subject to illness, death, separation, disappointment, or mindless actions. All beings are subject to aging, illness, death, separation, disappointment, and the results of their actions. When one is mindful of these facts and reflects often on these facts, the entire Eightfold Path is given life. I love that line. when we're and this. So the Buddha is teaching us directly. How do we develop the Eightfold Path? The first thing we do is we think about things that most people don't want to think about, and I'm talking about on a profound level, to consider what is my relationship to aging and sickness. What is my relationship to not taking responsibility for my actions, to not taking responsibility to karma? What is my reaction to impermanence or my ignorance of it? How much do I want to ignore it? That's what and when we can do that, then the entire Eightfold Path is given life. Being mindful of these facts, one will maintain the Eightfold Path, develop it, and cultivate it. All distractions are abandoned and all obsessions are destroyed. Pretty bold statement when you think about it, isn't it? But the Buddha was not given to hyperbole. He only it's amazing when you read the suttas, because there's a lot of them and there's a lot of words in it. I've never yet found one wasted word. And I think I might do that occasionally myself, but not in the Buddha. What he taught was the truth, and he always got to the point. I'm going to read that again. All distractions are abandoned and all obsessions are destroyed. I have some commentary in there in the sutta that I'm just pass over because I've been saying it anyway. So the Buddha concludes this sutta with this verse. Subject to birth, aging, and death, run-of-the-mill people are repelled by those that suffer from that which afflicts themselves. Of course, we all do that, don't we? End quotes. It would not be fitting for one awakened to be repelled by others' delusions. I remain mindful of the Dhamma without accommodation, without needing it to be any different than it is, the essence of distraction. I have overcome intoxication with youth, health, and the world. I know the end of clinging, renunciation. I know this as rest and as calm. For me, energy arose and unbinding clearly understood. Sensual pleasures and sensory attachments have been abandoned. Having left all delusion behind, my path is complete. He didn't have to describe it in any other way except that he left all delusion behind. Again, from ignorance, 12 causative links, all suffering arises from that. That's an expression or a description of wrong view, a deluded view. The three fetters that are often talked about are greed, aversion, the things that keep us stuck in suffering, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. And if you look at the Eightfold Path and the general teachings of the Dhamma, it addresses those three common characteristics that we all have as human beings. It addresses greed or craving, wanting more of something, or the opposite of that same coin, aversion, not wanting what we inevitably have to get from life, and the deluded thinking that we have some control over that process, or that if I can establish a strong enough or big enough or bellicose enough ego personality, you might take the reference, you might not, then I can control everything, you know. And of course it dooms us all to suffering, and if you have influence on people, it dooms the people that you have influence over. And I'm not talking about one bellicose individual, I'm talking about us all. But the opposite is also true too, and we've all experienced that, I think. As we've taken to the Dhamma and we've developed a more realistic view of life and a calmer and peaceful and more mindful existence, the people closest to us, their lives are improved too. Isn't that right? And again, that shouldn't even be a goal. It's just a consequence of awakening. And imagine if more people did it. So that's the end of the talk today. We'll go around, but are there any questions directly related to this talk? So we'll start with Becky. Becky, good to see you again.
Thank you.
We've missed you.
Thank you. That was an excellent talk. And there was a lot to think about. And I got, as you were talking, I just got it. the briefest glimpse of what it might be like to live your life like that. Just for a second. And, you know, I haven't been here, and I've been sort of thinking about the things I should have been doing, but not doing them. So, when I came today, I felt a little like I had really gotten too far away from the Sangha and the Dharma. I am still working on trying to really establish a routine meditation. You know, establish a routine for my meditation.
Yeah.
And I haven't succeeded in doing that, which is okay. I'm going to keep trying. What I seem to do now is I meditate when I'm agitated.
Yeah.
Instead of making it part of my life, I wait till I get to that point where I have to do something, and then I go meditate. And of course, even in that situation, it helps tremendously.
Yeah.
But I realize that that's not the most advantageous way of you know, following the Eightfold Path. So while you were talking, I was just thinking about an experience I had with a very dear and very old friend. We've been friends for like 50 years. And how I did not help the situation by my reaction. And rather than responding, reacting, you know, consistently over a 10-day visit. And I probably could have, I know I could have made my experience would have been much more peaceful if I had been able to realize at the time what kind of reaction I was having rather than responding to what was going on and stopping and thinking and using, you know, I can, thinking back on it, I can think of so many times that I could have used noble silence and it probably would have opened up the whole situation to a much, you know, more sort of real and closening of the relationship rather than a sort of making it a little awkward.
Yeah.
So that's where I am, and I thank you, and I'm going to continue to work on it.
That's great. Thank you. I'm so glad you're here today.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever had a student that didn't say those words, that, you know, I should meditate more often or them.
Right,
you know.
Right.
Even aversion is a good motivation to at least get you on the cushion. And you show great mindfulness by recognizing that. What you just talked about, the 10-day visit, I thought about, boy, somebody had just taught me about noble silence 61 years ago, my whole life would be different.
I've used it. I've practiced it a couple of times, and I've always been absolutely amazed
but
at what it does.
You have to have some mindfulness to know that you got
to
keep your hold your tongue. You know,
I just kept letting that second arrow hit me every single time. It was really bad.
But we do it to ourselves. The other, you know, that what you started there with, you just had that brief glimpse of what it would be like to live your life like that. I think when that happens, and it happens to me often, I think it's the last thing that kind of gets me to well up and almost brings tears to my eyes. When I realize it in the moment, it happened on retreat. At the end of retreat, we always thank the first the kitchen staff and then Karen, who helps organize it, you know, the business end of it. And then it happened to be that the senior monk was there too. So we, but as I was, as we were thanking the kitchen staff, who do, they do, you can just feel it and taste it in their food, how dedicated they are to providing these simple meals. They're so mindful of it. As I was thanking it, did you notice that I just welled up, and I had to catch myself, and it was because of the truth of the moment, and being able to experience that, and it's just wonderful. I wonder how you took.
I was actually like relieved because the first retreat I was on, you welled up quite a few times, and I was crying, John. But I was crying that entire time too on that retreat. So.
it's those moments of deep connection that really get me going, especially when I see it through other people. I think what really got me going is that one of the kitchen staff, she was almost embarrassed by being called out, and I didn't mean it to embarrass her, but it was just so sweet, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what gets me going. Thank you, Becky.
Thank you,
Jen. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Yeah, this was great. This really simplified some things and loosened up some things. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I think that first restating of the First Noble Truth, because I mean, I've heard you say that so many times, but just within that context of what to think about and what to accept and move on from. And the first three things to think about that the Buddha talked about, but the first, I don't remember how he says it, keep your mindfulness on,
you
know what it is. Those first three were, of course those things, but the fourth and the fifth they really struck me, because those are the things that you spend your day being distracted by.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I mean, all day long. And, you know, when I'm in when I have a mind of equanimity, I'm not thinking about those things. But when I'm distracted, even if I know that I'm distracted, even if I can see that I'm distracted, even if I'm watching my thoughts and knowing that those thoughts are clinging, even if I'm watching one ego arise, becoming that ego, and then becoming another ego right after that to repress the first ego, and you know, I'm watching it happen, but still can't, you know, get out of it.
Yeah.
I see how in those moments, if you can ask yourself the questions of, you know, what are you thinking about?
Yeah.
Is this, I will be recording this and listening to it over and over again, because the fourth thing that you said, which was, I'm not over being, what is it? Attached to, I can't remember now. Yeah, I'm going to have to listen to that fourth thing over and over again.
When you say thing, what are you talking about? The fourth, there were five things that the Buddha said you should think about.
You mean the fourth...
Attachment to...
To death. It just simply...
No, it was death, there was sickness, aging, death, or aging, sickness, death, and then four was...
Well, the fifth is impermanence.
Right, but the fourth one was...
How come I don't even remember.
Being things that you associate yourself with.
That's where I got confused. Okay. The fourth is impermanence, the fifth is karma.
Okay.
So, and those are the two... If you look at every one of these, they all are an aspect of impermanence,
right,
too. And that's really that profound nature. I think
separation.
You remember...
Separation, disappointment. Separation from what you think you want. Yeah.
Right.
Yes, and that really is...
Separation from all you hold dear.
Yeah. Yes.
Which means separation from your ego self.
Right.
That's what it's pointing to. And remember, Kandana awakened, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. What he was really talking about are his own self-referential views. And you remember on retreat when the Buddha describes his awakening in the Nagara Sutta. He got stuck in self-referential views, is what kept him stuck, even who eventually awakened. It's where we get stuck. It's at that point. It's where separation, disappointment, that's what causes stress.
Mm-hmm.
I'm losing something. I'm losing myself in this moment. Even in an argument, the reason why we get in an argument is because we think we're going to lose something of ourselves. So usually we'll start getting louder and start moving our hands around, et cetera, whatever we have to do to win an argument. Because we're afraid that if we don't win that argument, we're going to lose our ego personality,
mm-hmm,
that there's something of value there. That's all part of the separation, disappointment. All part of impermanence.
So if you're separated from something that you hold dear, that's so subtle, and it's all that it can be so many things.
A lifelong tension that we don't
know. So if I'm concerned about dying, or I'm concerned about being sick, or I'm concerned about aging, those things are blatantly, obviously, out of my control. But the subtle things, you know, like maybe I really could control how my spouse is acting right now.
yeah.
You know, so it really helps you get back into Reiki.
Yeah, that's the point. And there's nothing. You're those things controlling sickness and death. They can. In some people, they become the complete. Look, I don't know why I was thinking about Howard Hughes. You might not be old enough to remember.
No, I do. Yeah.
Look at how they a brilliant and incredibly one of the wealthiest men that's ever lived, one of the smartest, and yet he lived the last years of his life. I don't remember how many, holed up in a hotel room because he was afraid he was going to get a cold. I mean, that's the kind of obsession that type of thinking can lead to. Like losing something, you know, that is itself inherently impermanent. We don't have any control over it, you know.
When you talk about those big things, though, like death and sickness, and then it's sort of like an exaggeration. It helps you to understand the small day-to-day things.
Yes.
Because there's these, what I call them big things, I don't know if that's, but there's these big things that you can absolutely understand you have no control over.
Yeah.
Then you can bring that understanding once down to, well, it's the same thing as worrying about whether that flower is going to grow and get four buds on it before my guests come.
Yes,
you know,
that's right.
It's the same thing,
And if it does...
I might be able to do something about it. Let me just go out there and water it one more time. I'll put some fertilizer on it. Maybe it'll... It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Making yourself crazy for no reason.
There's nothing wrong with feeding the flower and watering it properly.
No, but
you can't get obsessed with it. If the motivation is, you know, if it grows, it grows, it doesn't, then
that's
you're...
good. It's a flower, and I want it planted, and it might grow and it might not.
Yep.
But to try to make it look absolutely perfect at a certain time...
So that you look perfect.
So that
right.
you
and,
look
And reflect,
perfect.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But that's what we do. That's what we do with the ego cells. And look at the stress that's there, and a simple flower growing. But because we create an attachment to it being something different or to grow quicker, we create stress in our lives. And you're right, it's the subtle things that really get us.
It's the subtle things, yes.
Good class. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. Hearing you talk, I think about how strange the human mind is, because you can elicit the same response in your body to a glass falling off a table as you can to hitting a kid with your car.
Yeah.
It's so funny that the mind, you're releasing adrenaline, you're feeling anxious, and the human mind can't distinguish between the two, and that's where all of this comes in so handy to make you realize that it happens, or it has happened, and not to obsess over it, but, you know, take the next step, whatever that may be, call 911, get out the broom, and not obsess over it.
Yeah.
But it's hard to do.
It's very hard to do. Again, that's why we have a eightfold path rooted in concentration, because our minds don't naturally do that, especially once they're conditioned in ignorance.
Yeah,
you know. We'll blame ourselves for a glass falling off a table, and maybe even blame ourselves for getting into a little fender bender, rather than learn what caused those in the first place. Putting the glass a little too close to the edge, or et cetera.
Being distracted while you were driving. The story.
And understanding where that distraction came from.
Yeah.
It's so important.
I mean, I find that through this and through, basically, most significantly, by concentrating on doing what I'm doing when I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And not trying to do 15 things at the same time. Mm-hmm. Things go so much more smoothly.
Yeah.
You know, when I do catch myself and say, no, let's do this, back and wait. And this is done, you'll go over there and do that.
Yeah. And it brings such peace and freedom. And mundane things too. I would bet you're talking about. You know, we all can be mindful of the big things most of the time anyway, but we miss our whole life by the other things. Very profound. Thank you, Mary. Debbie, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. So, what comes up for me mostly in terms of acceptance of aging, death, and all that is, for me, I'm context of now, accepting that it's hard to take all this in, it's hard to remember it, absorb it, and when I do, it's hard to remember it. That's frustrating. So accepting that right now is part of what I'm trying to do. But one of the things that came up for me was just the frustration. This whole thing just pointed out to me my frustrations with not being successful, how hard it is, and not being successful at integrating these teachings. And especially, it seems like with summer, that I'm much more into the craving, the flowers, I totally understand, like wanting my yard to get, to be like I wanted, and buy little things from, my house, and chopping too much, or whatever, and just having trouble separating from things, the little things. So I kind of felt overwhelmed because I'm not making that much progress. So one of the thoughts that came up for me is I need a lot of repetition, partly because of my memory issues, but just because that's how I learn too.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love is, this is a request for you. work more. is that, you have these teachings on your computer, online, and I never seem to have, it's a big deal for me to find time to do my meditation, and that's kind of a priority, so I don't usually get to read these things. But one of the things I do is I listen to tapes in my car when I drive to and from, and that's one of the ways I take in and absorb things, like on my on a CD or something, where it's so it's the repetition, it's helpful. So I was thinking, I need to get your book on a CD so I can listen to it. The book that we read, the 10-week thing.
Yeah.
Because I keep wanting to get back to it and read it, and I rarely have time. And I think, one of the ways I've read books over the years is in my car, audio books, work for me. So, that came up today. Of course, that's a need to self-reference.
No, I think it's a great suggestion.
No, but I have a CD player. But not a tape.
Yeah.
No.
The car's not valuable.
Well, mine is old. That, I actually have one, because that'll, then you can listen on your phone.
Is it possible to download your talks?
Yeah, there's a few. The book itself is not on tape yet, and I'll look into it. I think that's a good idea. But the talks are all accessible in a few different formats. One is on the Podbean podcast. One is through iTunes. One is directly on the website. I've now put all the podcasts that are on Podbean directly on the website, and you could listen.
I've done that a few times. It just, you know, I don't look at my phone all day at work. You know, when I leave work, I see who called me or what.
Yeah.
That's how I am so separated from media compared to young people.
You're lucky. Well, I will look into doing that, putting it on, and I'll put the new book. It hasn't even published yet, so I'll see what that's involved. I don't think it's all that much. I think that my publisher will automatically do that for a small fee. So,
but these are available as podcasts, so I can download the podcast and not be using my data and playing it in the car. That's always my
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. That's always my
big. You can get an app for your phone.
Yeah,
you can get
his
podcast
put
on your phone.
Yeah.
And then just listen to it with headphones in your car.
Automatically.
But you can only do that with the podcast. You can't do that with the book.
Yeah.
But there's a link on the website on the top right-hand corner. I think it says video podcast. There's a link there that you can download the app onto your smartphone. Mm-hmm. And then you'll just have to hit that, and it'll play the most recent talks, I think, anyway.
You can tell the app to keep... You can tell the app that you want to follow you.
And oh, that's right.
It'll automatically download every podcast as it comes along. So it's just always on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if you don't get to listen to it, you have to take some of them off because they might, you know...
They pile up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you can do the same with iTunes,
too. It's just
too.
A thing on your phone. It's really simple. And you can also just use, you can use any podcast app on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah,
I use the one that was already on my phone, and I just searched you, and it just came up, and you can just download your podcast.
Yeah, that's right. You don't need to go to Podbean or
to
iTunes
Podbean,
or anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Never
can
download an app.
Trust me,
well,
it's so easy.
Wait, I am going to, this came up on retreat too, I am going to build an app that'll be a reflection of the website, which means once you have it on your phone, you'll be notified of new posts and talks, mm-hmm. etc., and it'll just be right through that app that you can listen to, listen to all these brilliant teachings.
Thank you.
thanks for the suggestion. I'll look into it. The new book I'm really excited about, but I'm still writing it. I thought it would be published before the retreat. But
You're still writing it?
Yeah, I realized that
I thought it was at the publisher.
It was, and I pulled it back, and I said, wait a minute, it needs a little bit more of this and a little bit more of that.
Are you clinging?
I'm clinging and I'm craving. So. But it's close. I wouldn't say I'm proud of it, but it's a book that I wish I had come across 20 years ago. I know that sounds pretty arrogant
nice.
To say that, but
yeah.
I'm really pleased with it. So that I'm going to definitely look into putting that on.
I like the cover a lot.
Yeah, I do too.
It's very
yeah.
nice.
Okay, well, thank you for a great class. Two announcements. Our Sangha picnic is July 15th with a rain date the 16th. Info's on the website and linked in the email. There was something else, but I can't think of what it is. Our retreat's coming up October, our fall retreat. Hopefully you can join. I think it's going to be beautiful up there then. Info on the website on that, too.
Oh, I'm going with you.
So we'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.